Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, we'll hear more about a new state audit. It looks back at what happened during a 2020 COVID outbreak at a state-run veterans home where 36 residents died. We'll also discuss the news this week that the U.S. Supreme Court could be poised to overturn Roe v. Wade. We'll get reaction and hear what it could mean for Illinois. We'll listen to a report on families with children who have intellectual and physical disabilities. Getting home care for them is proving harder. Legislation before the Illinois governor could make it a human rights violation to deny renting to a person based on their source of income. We'll explain. And what does research into carjackings tell us about the spike in those crimes? Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll hear about a state audit released this week that examines the 2020 deadly COVID outbreak at the LaSalle Veterans Home. We'll also discuss legislation now on the governor's desk that would make it a human rights violation to deny a potential renter because of their source of income. Those stories and more this hour. Governor J.B. Pritzker says the Supreme Court is starting down a dangerous path with a draft opinion suggesting it could overturn Roe v. Wade. Pritzker says that opinion is terrifying for what it could do to constitutionally protected rights besides abortion. He worries same-sex marriage could be in danger if the Roe opinion becomes a final ruling.
If they can reverse 50 years of settled law, then every Supreme Court decision that has made this country freer and fairer can be reversed by this court.
Meanwhile, many of the Republican candidates for Illinois governor are supporting the possible rollback of Roe v. Wade, with one notable exception. Hannah Ferris has more on that.
Businessman Gary Rabine says he welcomes the reversal of Roe and that the country must do all it can to protect the rights of the unborn. State Senator Darren Bailey says if he's elected governor, he would end taxpayer-funded abortions. Venture capitalist Jesse Sullivan wants to bring back parental notification for minors seeking abortions. Meantime, Aurora Mayor Richard Irvin did not have a statement on the ruling. Irvin has said before that he opposes abortion, but his campaign said he won't comment until after the Supreme Court's final opinion, which may not come until after the June 28th GOP primary. Former State Senator Paul Schimpf and Max Solomon are also on the ballot. I'm Hannah Ferris.
Illinois has become an oasis for people seeking abortions as neighboring states have restricted access, and now the state could become even more significant for patients across the nation if the U.S. Supreme Court finalizes that draft decision. It would leave abortion access up to individual states, potentially leaving more patients to seek out Illinois. Kristen Schorsch of WBEZ provides some clarity, and she spoke with Melba Laura.
Kristen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us first, what is the law in Illinois when it comes to abortion access?
Well, abortion is legal here. And even if Roe v. Wade is overturned, in 2019, the state legislature passed a bill that Governor Pritzker signed into law that effectively protects abortion access no matter what. It's the law.
And are there any restrictions when it comes to patients seeking an abortion in Illinois?
Right. Well, so there are some restrictions. I mean, the law in Illinois bans abortions when a fetus is viable. So when it can live outside the uterus, and a doctor determines when that viability is. So if it's a healthy pregnancy, it's usually around 24 to 28 weeks. But that also means that you can't get an abortion in the last 12 to 16 weeks of your pregnancy. Now, there are some exceptions to the ban to preserve the life and health of a pregnant person. And there are, you know, Illinois also recently struck down what many people saw as a restriction, basically this requirement that doctors notify the parents of a minor seeking an abortion. And that's supposed to be repealed on June 1st.
Kristen, why does Illinois law supersede what the draft opinion from the Supreme Court foreshadows?
Because the draft opinion allows individual states to decide restrictions around abortions and abortion access.
Well, how vulnerable then is Illinois' abortion protections to legal challenges?
I mean, you could see, you know, a bunch of lawsuits, perhaps, but experts I talk to say it's not vulnerable in the courts because abortion protections are not part of the state constitution. It's a law that was passed by the legislature, signed by the governor. So it's vulnerable in the sense that if there's a governor and state lawmakers that don't support it, it could be repealed and there could be a new law put in place. Also, it could be threatened if there's federal legislation banning abortions, and that could supersede state law. Now, Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul, he released a statement, and he's tasked with defending state laws in court. And he said that he's proud Illinois will remain, quote, a reproductive healthcare oasis.
We've been following so much reaction from Democrats, Republicans, all kinds of reaction. But what's next? What are you and others watching out for?
Well, there's a lot of things I'm watching out for. I'm watching out for to see if there's mass protests for or against this draft ruling, if there are going to be more patients flocking to Illinois, you know, who are seeking an abortion, if there's going to be more protections and resources for people traveling to Illinois from states that may ban abortion or make it harder to get one. Also, these potential lawsuits, even if they're frivolous. And also, if there's a chilling effect on doctors and nurses who work in abortion clinics here. I'm also looking to see if there's an increase in volunteers for people who oppose abortion. So there's a lot to look out for.
That's reporter Kristen Schorsch speaking with Melba Laura. As other states in the Midwest and beyond are set to roll back abortion rights if and when that opinion becomes final, Illinois Democrats this week vowed to keep the state a safe haven for legal abortions in a post-Roe world. Here's State Senator Melinda Bush of Grays Lake in a news conference with Governor Pritzker and other pro-choice legislators on Tuesday.
I've got a right to vote in this country. I should have a right to my own reproductive health. I don't bear children any longer, but I am here to my dying day to stand with this governor and these women and men who believe in our rights as human beings.
Already, as Illinois has expanded abortion rights in recent years, those seeking abortions from out of state have increased, especially from red states that have restricted abortion access. In 2020, nearly 9,700 of the 46,000 abortions performed in Illinois were for non-residents, a nearly 30% increase from the year before. Abortion rights advocates predict that number could double. Our State House Senator Hannah Meisel spoke with Planned Parenthood of Illinois' Chief Strategy and Operations Officer Kristen Schultz about how her organization is preparing for the influx of abortion seekers to Illinois if Roe is overturned.
There's a potential that 26 states lose access to abortion care, which represents just about half of the U.S. Population. So the numbers could be quite high. I mean, Illinois thinks about our region from Montana to Mississippi and even potentially beyond. And the figures are pretty clear, at least about current abortion provision in Illinois. And there's a chance that that could double just across the state in general at a very high level. But, you know, it remains to be seen how many people can pull together the resources to make long distance travel to care for their children. There are so many barriers standing in the way of patients who need care from out of state.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've seen that number pinned as anywhere from 14,000 to 20,000. What are you guys?
It's really hard to tell. And I've seen similar sort of estimates or even higher than that. So I think it remains to be seen.
Okay. Regardless of the exact number of out-of-state patients Illinois begins to see when Roe is officially overturned and, you know, states respond in kind, we have just about 29 or 30 abortion care providers in Illinois, and that means that there's going to be a bottleneck. Can you tell me a little bit about what Planned Parenthood of Illinois has been doing to plan for this influx?
So we have been planning for this for years. And we have first thought about the physical capacity we need to see a great number of patients. And so what we did is in 2018, we opened a health center in Flossmoor, which is on the eastern side of the state, to care for patients who may have to come from the east. In 2020, we opened Waukegan, which is our health center on the northern part of the state, to anticipate patients needing to come from the north. We also have health centers in the middle of the state, in central Illinois, spanning from Springfield to Champaign, to care for patients who are more in the sort of central region of Indiana and potentially Missouri. So we have cared for, in a lot of ways, the physical capacity to see many patients, including many abortion patients. Now, in the last couple of years, COVID has been a challenge, staffing has been a challenge, the labor market has been a challenge, and we continue to increase our staff capacity to see the influx of patients. So the big issues as we expand capacity are physical space and staff capacity to do the work. And we continue to move on increasing that capacity over time as we look towards this Supreme Court decision and other state regulations.
In addition to wanting to increase the physical space, you know, obviously you have these 17 existing clinics in Illinois. You know, I read in a Tribune article this week that Chicago Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa was talking about how, you know, maybe the Chicago City Council would have to change zoning to make more protected zones around clinics. Is that a big concern of yours, you know, that the overturning of Roe will further kind of embolden and energize anti-abortion rights activists, and there will be more picketing outside of clinics? You know, how would you want to approach that with the different municipalities that already host your clinics?
That's a great question. We do anticipate increased anti-abortion activity really at all levels, and physical safety of our staff and patients is paramount. And so I have not been as closely involved in the work on the regulatory side, but I welcome any added protection and care for our healthcare centers that local or regional elected officials are willing to help us secure.
But on the other side of that, are you at all worried that the places where your clinics already exist, are you worried about the municipalities kind of facing backlash and being pressured to, you know, kick those clinics out of their communities?
I think Planned Parenthood has a long history of managing challenges with our presence in communities. And we are there for the patients, and our doors will remain open. And so while, you know, anti-abortion sentiment continues to be something that we're concerned about, we are well-versed in how to manage that, and we'll continue to fight for access for our patients.
You also, of course, you know, in addition to physical space, you mentioned it requires people to make these clinics work. Do you have a number in mind of how many more abortion-providing doctors, nurses, other facility staff that Planned Parenthood would need to recruit?
Well, we have our internal plans that I won't speak about the specifics of, but as you think about the state of Illinois perhaps seeing a doubling of abortion care, I think it's incumbent upon all providers to think about potentially needing to double their own capacity. And so I can't share specific numbers at this time, but like many industries across the country, like healthcare across the country, I think every organization is trying to staff up and focus on both retention and hiring of staff across the organizations.
You know, you talked about in the beginning just the fact that abortion access, you know, now and especially in this post-Roe world we are heading toward, will depend on individuals' resources to be able to travel to states that still have legal abortions available. Let's just talk about abortion funds in general. Like,
yeah,
how critical is that to Planned Parenthood's mission?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. Abortion funds are critical to the abortion provision and to patient access across the country and in our region. And there are national networks of abortion funds. NNAF, the National Network of Abortion Funds, is one that nationalizes, sort of has a national network, even if you're unable to sort of, you know, by name track that those particular funds are part of that network. One of our organizations that we work closely with is the Chicago Abortion Fund, or CAF, and they are part of that national network. And they are extremely strong in our region and are just a critical piece of this abortion ecosystem in supporting patients to get access as they travel from restricted states to protected states.
Let's talk about the proliferation, particularly in the last 6 months. The Guttmacher Institute said in 2020 that we had passed the point where more than half of abortions in the U.S. are medication abortions.
Now we're currently, as we have been through the pandemic, allowed to mail mifepristone, to mail medication abortion to patients in our state. And so you've seen startup organizations start to provide medication abortion through telehealth and through what is sometimes called direct-to-patient medication abortion. And Planned Parenthood of Illinois has also launched the same service earlier in April, where we provide the medication abortion visit via telehealth and then can mail those medications to patients in Illinois. What we're hearing from both patients and staff is that it is a very helpful access point for patients who are not located near a clinic. It is a huge win for health equity and for access. Illinois is a very large state, and not everyone is proximate to a health center. And so what we're hearing is that patients are satisfied with the ability to access the care, and staff is also feeling very confident about their ability to provide that care and the efficiency that it brings to our organization.
So far, in this proliferation of abortion pills by mail, is it mostly Illinois residents, or is it residents from out of state who are coming to Illinois to use these services? Do you have any stats on that so far?
What we do know is that to provide direct-to-patient medication abortion, the patient needs to be in Illinois for the telehealth visit, and they have to have an Illinois address to have the medications shipped. And so for Planned Parenthood of Illinois, we welcome those other organizations also providing direct-to-patient medication abortion in Illinois. And for us, it was important to give that as an option to our existing patients for continuity of care. And again, to continue to, if able, move those patients out of our health centers so that we can focus on seeing the patients in the health centers who have to be seen in the health centers. You know, all providers, whether they're brick and mortar or telehealth, they will be needed to provide care in Illinois based on what we talked about and the surge. Overall, Illinois is likely to see at least a doubling in abortion demand into the state, and that varies by region. In some places of the state, we might see up to five times the existing abortion demand just based on, you know, the geographic proximity to other population centers.
That's Kristen Schultz of Planned Parenthood of Illinois speaking with Hannah Meisel. There's more of Statewide on the way. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford, and still ahead, we'll talk about a newly released audit. It looks back at a deadly COVID outbreak at an Illinois veteran's home. Well, up next, there was music, but it wasn't a celebration. It was a commemoration of those lost in the fight for fair pay and safe conditions. Workers' Memorial Day is observed across the country every April 28th, and Peter Medlin has more on an event that took place in Marseilles.
That fight turned bloody 90 years ago in Marseilles. During the throes of the Depression, local laborers protested a company bringing in out-of-state, underpaid workers to build a dam. During the peaceful protest, company personnel open-fired and killed local worker Big Steve Sutton and wounded 21 more. And just as the gunfire cleared, news of a local labor agreement reached Marseilles. Laborers Local 393 was born on that tragic day and still stands on Main Street, just a block from where the dam was built on the Illinois River. Mike Matika is a member of the Laborers Local 362 and a community activist.
And we're here today to make sure that story, that bravery, that courage to build a movement and demand decent conditions is not forgotten.
The Illinois State Historical Society unveiled a plaque to honor Big Steve and make sure the history of labor in Illinois is cast in bronze. Chuck Stanley is a board member of the State Historical Society and presented at the event.
There's an old labor song called Joe Hill. In the song, there is a line, "It takes more than guns to kill a man." And I think that's the notion that is echoed in this marker.
The peaceful night on the Illinois River was also full of music and union songs. The performer to bring them to life was a former Marseilles resident, Rage Against the Machine guitarist, and workers' rights activist.
My name's Tom Morello, and I'm a union man. This first song I'm going to play is a fighting song. This is a union song.
for the fine auto workers who were twisted, tricked, and robbed.
The crowd of Marseille's residents and local 393 members rushed on stage with Morello as he belted out old and original labor anthems.
For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time for our brothers.
The former Rage guitarist and union member himself also took the time to talk about the renewed push for organized labor. Unions have seen a wave of wins over the past year, with workers from Starbucks and Amazon successfully organizing. Morello and other labor activists hope it's momentum for a movement in America. In Illinois, labor is also on the ballot this November. Voters will decide whether a workers' rights amendment should be enshrined in the Illinois state constitution. The amendment says it would guarantee the right to a safe workplace and make it illegal to pass laws interfering or diminishing workers' rights to organize. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker also spoke at the event. He talked about the importance of memorializing what happened in Marseilles almost a century ago and about the proposed amendment.
On day one, I got to work putting a stop to the previous administration's union-busting and anti-worker agenda. We banished from the dictionaries of this state three words: right to work.
So-called right to work laws give workers the option to join a union or not. Labor activists say federal law already gives those protections and that right to work measures weaken union bargaining strength. On Workers' Memorial Day, Morello closed out the night with a rendition of one of America's most famous songs, "This Land Is Your Land." But he highlighted the original final lyrics of Woody Guthrie's Dust Bowl protest song.
As I was walking, I saw a sign there. And that sign said, no trespassing. But on the other side, didn't say nothing. That side was made.
The plaque in memory of Big Steve Sutton can be found in downtown Marseilles, right on the Illinois River. I'm Peter Medlin.
Families say they often need care workers with special skills to support their children with physical and intellectual disabilities. But the care industry has been losing workers for years. When the pandemic struck, the situation only got worse. And now, as Farah Anderson of the Illinois Student Newsroom reports, local families are often left to their own devices to find the care they need.
16-year-old Morgan Quigley sits inside a White House in Villa Grove, a small town south of Champaign-Urbana. He's wearing headphones and gripping a video game controller. It's 7:30 on a Wednesday morning, and Alyssa Marisi, one of Morgan's two home caretakers, has arrived to take him to school. Morgan challenges Alyssa to a few rounds of Fortnite, but it's not exactly a fair matchup.
Does anybody else crush you like you crush me?
No.
No one?
Morgan isn't just any teenager playing video games and trying to get out of going to school. He has both autism and epilepsy. He needs almost constant care, something his caregiver says isn't always easy, especially when she's working part-time.
We're just trying to make sure he always has somebody, but he doesn't always have somebody.
Morgan's mother, Megan, works several jobs, including massage therapy and bookkeeping, averaging about 60 hours a week. She says she works as much as she can to pay for childcare, her largest expense, which costs more than her rent, food, and utility costs combined. And she can't hire just any caretaker. She needs someone who can handle Morgan's behavior and keep him safe if he has a seizure. Once the pandemic hit, she was struggling even more.
I didn't even know how I was going to pay my bills at that point. I had nobody for almost 4 weeks at one point. It is a terribly stressful situation because being a single mom, I have to show up to work because I am the only breadwinner.
As Megan discovered, the pandemic brought a national labor shortage, forcing many workers to stay home or find jobs with more security. Data from the University of California at Berkeley shows that around 10% of childcare workers left during the pandemic. That's over 100,000 people. Brenda Eastham, the director of the University of Illinois Child Care Resource Services, says families of children with disabilities struggle to find caregivers in every single central Illinois county. But this isn't just a local problem. Julie Cashin researches child care policy at the Century Foundation, a progressive think tank in Washington, D.C. She says the care industry in America has been in crisis for decades and that parents who need specialized care are still paying more than they can afford.
the sad truth is, even as parents are paying as much as they can, the people who are working in childcare, the early educators, are not being paid well. So, you know, there's this disconnect because it truly costs a lot of money to do this well.
Many families pay as much as 35% of their income for childcare. The Build Back Better Act, President Biden's sweeping infrastructure bill, sought to reduce that to 7%, but has been stalled in the U.S. Senate. Back in the town of Villa Grove, Megan is still struggling to find care for Morgan as more workers quit or just stop showing up. Now, as she prepares to pay more for care as school lets out for summer break, she says she's taking it one day at a time.
You can't look at the long term with kids like mine. You just go, okay, today we have to do this. What are we going to do tomorrow? Because if you go past tomorrow, everything falls apart.
I'm Farrah Anderson, Illinois Student Newsroom.
In late 2020, a COVID outbreak at the LaSalle Veterans Home led to 36 residents dying. Since then, there's been a lot of finger-pointing over what mistakes were made there, and families of 27 of the veterans are suing the state. A state audit was released this week, taking a closer look at what happened, and our Statehouse editor Hannah Meisel is back with us to sort some things out. Hannah, take us back to the fall of 2020. The LaSalle Veterans Home, it was locked down, a lot of places were, due to COVID, and the goal was to prevent the spread of the virus because those people who live in these veterans homes, they're older people. Many of them have some serious health conditions. So how did this occur anyway?
Well, I mean, just like the outbreaks at other nursing homes in Illinois and throughout the country, you know, all over the world, when you're living in a congregate setting, diseases can spread pretty rapidly if the right precautions aren't taken. And honestly, sometimes if the right precautions are, it's just, you know, you're always going to have weaknesses. And COVID, you know, it's quite contagious, obviously. It's even more contagious now. But, you know, back in 2020, we didn't have vaccines yet. It's almost a really sad irony is that, you know, these folks died right before vaccines were being rolled out to nursing home residents, which included the veterans homes residents. We have a timeline that, you know, we've basically known, but this audit further refines that timeline. And so in very early November of 2020, that's when the home started detecting the first cases of positive residents, positive staff, and it just kind of grew exponentially from there. But things didn't really get to be public until most of the outbreak had already spread in, you know, mid to late November of 2020. And that's when, you know, I and other of our colleagues began reporting on the outbreak and asking questions. The first veterans died, you know, not too long after they were infected. You know, about a week into the outbreak. And then the last of the 36 veterans who died passed on the 1st of January, 2021.
So, Hannah, remind us what happened, the initial consequences of this outbreak. What occurred there?
Pretty soon after, maybe like a week or two after questions began being asked, the governor fired the home's administrator and a deputy. And then in early January of 2021, the governor asked for the resignation of former Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs Director Linda Chapelivia, who had been a Democratic lawmaker before that. There had been an initial hearing on what had gone on, and this was, you know, around Thanksgiving of 2020, and that's when we heard initial things like, oh, there was the incorrect type of hand sanitizer in dispensers in the home. Also claims that staff members were congregating in the staff break room maskless. But after the governor, you know, did his initial round of firings, he had asked the state's Department of Human Services Inspector General to do a report. But the report, you know, just focused on the Department of Veterans Affairs. And opponents, especially Republicans, they criticized him for keeping the scope of the investigation just to the Department of Veterans Affairs, because it was the Department of Public Health also who bears some responsibility here. And, you know, today's audit bears that out. And so, when that report came out April 30th of 2021, you know, that was pretty major. But this audit has been a long time coming. It was authorized by a House resolution last year, and it spreads a lot more blame.
The governor did take some action. Yet after the audit came out, the governor was quick to criticize Republicans about what was going on there in LaSalle.
We were at the dawn of the worst surge to date, and you may remember this is before we had vaccines. We were working against Republican elected officials who told people to defy mitigation efforts. We told people that they needed to follow those mitigations, but Republicans told them that they need not wear masks. They told people that they didn't need to get vaccinated. They told people that COVID wasn't serious. Those lies put people's lives at risk, especially the most vulnerable. Even as my team and I worked 18 hours a day for 9 months straight to fight them.
Now, Hannah, the governor, of course, becoming quite partisan with that response there. And he does have a point. There were Republicans at the time questioning some of these decisions, some of these mitigations. But this audit also lays a lot of blame, very critical, of the Department of Public Health, which is in Governor Pritzker's administration.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Thinking back after that report came out last spring, there was a series of hearings that went on. You know, a session was wrapping up with a billion other things that were going on, redistricting and energy and all that other stuff. But one of those hearings that featured Deputy Governor Sol Flores, who is in charge of agencies that deal with health and human services, including IDPH, including the Department of Veterans Affairs. And, you know, she pretty blatantly threw the Department of Veterans Affairs under the bus. And she claimed that the governor's office was misled about what was actually going on there. But the audit report seems to contradict that claim. The Department of Public Health, obviously, you know, the governor said this week when I questioned, again, why that investigation last spring only centered on the Department of Veterans Affairs and one could say shielded public health. And he said, well, look, public health was the one agency in charge of, you know, everything. And he basically said they were overloaded. But I think a lot of people would argue, well, hey, the LaSalle outbreak didn't happen until 8 months into the pandemic. And there was maybe time to staff up and to learn from all the nursing home outbreaks early on in COVID. The audit is very critical of the Department of Public Health. Let me read you one quote from the report. IDPH officials were informed of the increasing positive cases almost on a daily basis. IDPH failed to identify and respond to the seriousness of the outbreak. And the other thing that I think folks might find compelling is that the Department of Public Health didn't, you know, get any boots on the ground at the home until almost 2 weeks after the outbreak began. And the audit says all but four of the 36 residents who died had already tested positive for COVID prior to the agency's site visit on November 12th of 2020.
So, Hannah, I guess the real question now becomes, I mean, this happened several months ago now, but we're not likely to hear the end of it, especially in a political year. Is there going to be fallout for the Pritzker administration from this?
We've already seen Republicans test that messaging basically for the last year, year and a half since the outbreak began. And now that it's an election year and plenty of Republicans have campaign money behind them, you better bet that we're going to see campaign ads to this effect. And they would say it's a fair game because in 2018, Governor Pritzker, part of his campaign centered on former Governor Bruce Rauner's mishandling of the Legionnaires outbreak at the Quincy Veterans Home that killed 13 residents. Now, these two things are different. In the case of the Legionnaires outbreak, the Rauner administration did engage in somewhat of a cover-up, but it's a difficult issue, you know, especially because veterans are kind of one of those third rail populations. And when you don't treat veterans with the utmost, people get really, really upset.
That's Hannah Meisel, our State House editor. And just a reminder, we have a link to that newly released audit, which examines that 2020 deadly COVID outbreak at the LaSalle Veterans Home. It is available at our website at nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide. We have more to come on Statewide. Stay with us. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Michael Chavarria is executive director of the Hope Fair Housing Center, and he spoke recently with our reporter Maureen McKinney about a House bill, a piece of legislation that's now on the governor's desk that would make it a human rights violation to reject potential renters because of their source of income. Chicago and Cook County, as well as 19 other states, have such legislation currently. Here's that interview.
Housing providers have to treat all sources of income fairly. What it's really addressing is an issue that's experienced by those using non-traditional incomes or really non-wage incomes. So that might be something like SSI, Social Security Disability. A very common issue is experienced by those using child support or alimony. So that's often impacting single mothers who have to use those sources to help afford the rent. That is the very purpose of them. That's why child support is often negotiated in divorces and such, so that the children, regardless of changes in family dynamics, can still have all of their needs met. Further, what this really addresses in a big way, is the forms of discrimination experienced by those using rental subsidies or any form of housing subsidy. And what I mean by that is programs like the Housing Choice Voucher Program or the Veteran Affairs Supportive Housing Program. Combined, there's nearly 100,000 Illinois households using those two types of vouchers to help pay their monthly rent payment. And commonly, far too commonly, this is a rampant issue, those using those programs to help afford their rent have the door slammed in their face. Maybe it's calling a prospective landlord and asking if you accept vouchers. You know, it's a shame that that tends to be the first question that's asked. It's not how much is the rent or when is the unit available. It's do you accept vouchers? Because it's such a rampant issue. If you don't get past that question, you know that it's not for you. So the first thing you do is you ask if they have vouchers, and more often than not, you're told no. The door is shut in your face. You're told don't apply, don't bother coming to look at it. Or maybe you do look at it and you're invited to apply, and that's when you mention the voucher on your application. And then you'll find that the application is designed to automatically reject you because you have a voucher. Maybe it's an online automated application, or simply you'll just never get called back. So what HB 2775 says is, regardless of your income, if it's legal, if it's verifiable, if it's stable, then it needs to be treated fairly. No more stigmatizing various sources of income. And one reason this is very important is because research around the country, all over, time and again, has demonstrated that source of income discrimination, particularly when it is against those using housing subsidies like vouchers, that there are racial disparities. So one example would be in what's called fair housing testing that was done in the city of Chicago. What they found was that when someone contacted a landlord indicating they had a voucher, if they were white, they were more likely to be told that that voucher would be accepted than if they were black. And this pattern repeats itself in every study that's done all around the country. Source of income discrimination is the proxy. So what I mean by that is that they're getting away with discriminating against you on the basis of their race by using your participation in the voucher program as the proxy to do so. So it's not because you're black, it's because you have a voucher. But then when we test and we send in someone who is white and has a voucher, what we find out is all of a sudden the voucher isn't a problem. It's important for anyone who's thinking about this or interested in learning more about it to understand that the Housing Choice Voucher Program really is the entire country's, the United States, the federal government's largest investment into families with children. The goal of the program is to give the means necessary to afford that rent so that you can access the community of your choice, so that you have the agency over your life to decide what opportunities are most important to you. This bill is trying to say housing is a human right. We all have the right to access the housing which we have the means to afford, and we should not have the door slammed in our face.
When was the bill first proposed, and has it changed much from its original iteration?
This particular bill was introduced back in February of 21. It was introduced by the chief sponsor, Representative LaShawn Ford. And I'll just say it was the reason why it was introduced in that moment was because advocates were seeing those applying for emergency rental assistance that was given in response to COVID. Advocates were seeing that landlords, despite the fact that we were reading about them in the paper and on the news about the eviction moratorium and how this was impacting their business, what advocates were finding was that many of the clients they served and connected with emergency rental assistance to weather the storm that was COVID, their landlords were refusing to accept those. And we saw thousands of instances of this. For the first time ever, it was documented, you know, at the Illinois Housing Development Authority, was something like 40-something thousand times a tenant applied and their landlord would not complete the application for emergency rent assistance. The version of the bill that was introduced really was what source of income protections would look like in the ideal world, right? It was taking all of the lessons learned from other cities and other states around the country that have these protections and clearing up any ambiguity that we learned popped itself up in another state. We didn't want you to have to hire an attorney to understand this new law. But of course, there are many people involved, there are many stakeholders coming at this from different perspectives. So after over a year of negotiations with opposition, the bill was significantly changed. In the final amended form, it only amends the Illinois Human Rights Act. And what it does now, instead of providing the guidance on how to calculate income, instead of providing guidance on what happens if an eviction is filed as a result of source of income, to essentially say you must treat all legal income equally. You can't deny someone simply because you don't like where their income comes from. And I believe something has happened in recent times where the real estate industry is finally starting to confront that past. I think this was a big part of that effort.
Who's going to be helped by the legislation if it's enacted?
I think it's really important that we discuss the fact that we have a situation in which Illinoisans enlist in the military, and you know they fight to preserve democracy, to protect the American dream. They come home after serving. They're given this Veteran Affairs Supportive Housing voucher in order to whatever it is, to reestablish themselves in civilian life, whatever reason it was that they qualified. And then you get this as a sort of opportunity in return for your service. And then housing providers can just slam the door in your face and say, hey, I appreciate what you did for the country, but you're not going to rent here. I don't want the trouble of having to deal with your voucher, or the last voucher holder I rented to gave me problems. So it's a sort of complete stigmatization regardless of the individual. Well, what a lot of people don't realize when we talk about these rental subsidies is there's specific subsidies set aside called emergency housing vouchers, which are typically reserved for those who are experiencing like on the streets homelessness, or for those who are fleeing domestic violence or human trafficking. So advocates constantly are encountering people who maybe were given an emergency housing voucher so they could flee domestic violence. They're currently living with their abuser. There might be children who are also victim to this abuse, and they cannot get away from that abuser until they secure new housing. You're left with this terrible choice of homelessness or living with your abuser. You get this emergency housing voucher. Finally, there's light at the end of the tunnel. And then you spend months or years trying to find a landlord who will even accept it. The whole time you're trapped in that situation. The resource that society offered to help you get out of that, your one shot is just being rejected. You're being treated differently simply because you needed that helping hand in that moment. And we all did. You know, we all need this at some point. And I think COVID taught us that when for the first time we saw everybody in need of assistance. Source of income discrimination is very often the result of the stigmatization of those who are perceived to use the program. And what I mean by that is single Black mothers. I can't tell you the number of times I've met mothers who are sleeping in a car with their children, or who are spending every penny they had saved on a motel so that their children would have a roof over their head at night, because they have this voucher and they can't find a landlord that will accept it. I've met so many people who, after months or years of struggling to find a landlord who would accept their voucher, give it up. They gave it up because they could not live in the community they wanted to because no one would accept their voucher.
That's Michael Chavarria, Executive Director of the Hope Fair Housing Center, talking about legislation on the governor's desk to make it a human rights violation to reject potential renters because of their source of income. The legislation had opposition from organizations, including the Illinois Rental Property Owners Association, because of concerns that landlords could be accused of human rights violations if they don't want to enter into a contract for the Housing Choice Voucher Program that previously operated as Section 8 housing. New research is raising questions about what exactly is driving an increase in carjackings in Chicago. University of Chicago professor Robert Vargas looked at how often police recovered carjacked vehicles. He said what he found cuts the official police narrative that the carjacking surge can mostly be attributed to young people. And he spoke with criminal justice reporter Patrick Smith.
What first prompted your interest in the carjacking data here in Chicago?
Well, it was mainly the fact that carjacking was receiving a ton of coverage in the media, and in the neighborhood that I live in the city, neighbors, business owners were talking about it a lot and were deeply concerned. And so when I started paying attention to the media coverage and the police department's description of what was going on, I just saw a complete disconnect with the reality of what the data was showing and what was coming from our city leadership.
So you went searching for more answers about carjacking in Chicago, and in particular in this report you looked at how many of these carjacked vehicles are ever recovered by the police. What did you find?
Well, the data that we received through a Freedom of Information Act request indicate that just under 20% of carjacked vehicles are recovered by the police department. And I think when you look at these numbers, it's hard to line these facts up with the narrative that our city leaders have put out, that the spike is being driven by young people seeking joyrides. Because unless young people are extremely good at hiding cars after having gone for a joyride, it seems like there's some pretty strong economic incentives going on here and things linked to the informal economy. And carjacking makes sense as a potentially lucrative product to steal and then sell in the secondhand market.
I've been at press conferences with Superintendent David Brown in which he talks up the particularly young age of a carjack or something like that.
It's a shame that you'll hold a gun in someone's head just to joyride, but that seems to be what our young people are doing.
Why does the fact that so few carjacked vehicles are recovered by police undercut this idea that it's largely driven by young people, seeking joyrides?
Yeah, so I think the main thing here is that if the vast majority of carjacking incidents are being motivated by economic incentives, then it means that youth programming alone isn't going to be sufficient to address the problem. It means that the problem is being driven by economic need. And when you look at the fact that the carjacking spike occurred just as the pandemic and the economic downturn hit, it makes logical sense that a lot of the carjacking is tied to the tremendous increase in economic need in Chicago's disadvantaged neighborhoods.
Is there a danger to have our leaders pinning a crime problem on young people and describing the criminal activity as inherently irrational and unpredictable?
I think that there are already so many stereotypes that young kids of color face when they're walking through Chicago neighborhoods. And so to paint an issue like carjacking as like a youth issue, particularly a youth of color issue, I think unnecessarily reinforces stereotypes about these young people. That's not to say that we shouldn't be investing in additional programming, but there's something about scapegoating the youth population that I think probably does more harm than good.
That's University of Chicago professor Robert Vargas. His new study looks at Chicago carjackings. The Chicago Police Department did not respond to questions for this story. That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be with us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find all of our episodes at the website nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide. And our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.